Good afternoon. May it please the court, counsel. Diane Smith, registration 14340, appearing on behalf of the defendant, appellant, cross-appellant, Paula Gagne. Your Honors, in this case, the district court committed two fundamental errors in the order of January 22, 2013. First, he conflated Richard Gagne's obligation to pay money over the $25 shared budget with participation in selection of a subcontracted property manager. Second, Judge O'Dell awarded relief to Mr. Gagne for the $1,700 loan and the J. Gagne employment contract, even though no one, including the LLCs, had asked for that relief. We ask that you reverse those two particular rulings of the district court, but affirm the remainder. Your Honor, because we have an appeal and a cross appeal, and my issues are fairly limited, I would like to sit down at about 7 minutes, if possible.
That will be up to you to keep track of.
Thank you, sir. With respect to the interpretation of paragraph 4 of the LLC agreements, and if you have your iPads handy, this is at pages 87 to 89 of the exhibit record compiled in this case. The purpose of paragraph 4 was to protect the LLCs. Because in this case, Mr. Gagne contributed basically sweat equity, his time and labor, as part of his contribution to the development of these LLCs. In order to make sure that he had a dog in the fight, he had 2 years at $50 a month per unit to provide the property management services.
Was that above market? In other words, was that essentially a bonus to him, or was that just what the market would dictate for management?
That was essentially what the market would dictate, and what there was, Your Honor, in this was that to the extent that there was any excess over the 25, it was essentially a family arrangement to benefit him. So he got a minimum, and then once the 2 years was over, he got that minimum $25.
So it sounds like the $25 was really the market and the rest was a gratuity.
I believe that within the record, Your Honor, there may be some indication that market floated between those two figures during the time period that this was in effect. I don't think there was any one snapshot in time where they said it's only 25 and now it's 50. It floated. Okay.
Ms. Smith, while we've already interrupted you, if I can jump in here, cut to the chase on the issue that concerns me on this part from your side. Where did the court find that Ms. Gagne had the unilateral authority to pick a subcontractor, barring a situation, it clearly says so, if Mr. Gagne, Richard, doesn't cooperate or want to participate, then she can choose unilaterally the new subcontractor. As I understand the court's ruling in this case, the court said Ms. Gagne can unilaterally pick. But if she does that, he don't have to pay. I guess I'm having trouble, giving you a heads up in advance, with both of those, because I'm having trouble seeing where either of those come out of the contract. I don't see this general unilateral right on Ms. Gagne's part to select a new subcontractor, and I don't see anything on the face of the language that says Mr. Gagne doesn't have to pay if she does that. So I could be dead wrong, you all, but I'm looking to you. Help me out here. Where is this general unilateral right?
Judge Gabriel, if you look to paragraph 4F, and this is part of the problem that we have with this, that the judge really conflated those two. In essence, there are five sentences in paragraph 4F. And if you look at the last two, what it says is that if she decides to move forward, in other words, if there's a lack of cooperation within the first, as required by the first two sentences, she can move forward, he can cooperate. If he doesn't cooperate, she can move forward unilaterally to select the property manager. But there's no tie between selection of the property manager and payment of the $25.
Right, but let me back up though. I mean, the problem is I find these last couple sentences circular. I mean, it kind of says if she assumes the responsibility, it doesn't say when she can assume it. Then it says, talks about his cooperation. Then it says, if he doesn't cooperate, she kind of assumes the responsibility. I'm having trouble understanding that. And I know the trial judge said, you know, I had some trouble with the drafting of this. I don't think you were the drafts person.
I can simply say I was not the draft person on this agreement.
So maybe I'm asking to isolate, where does the unilateral authority come if he does cooperate? Or would you agree Ms. Gagne does not have the unilateral authority if Mr. Gagne cooperates and participates?
If he cooperated in the process of selecting a property manager, then they had to have unanimous agreement.
Okay.
If he did not cooperate in the process of selecting a property manager, then she could act unilaterally.
Okay, so is there anything in the record that suggests he didn't cooperate?
Your Honor, I think if you look at the pleadings that led up to this in the complaint and then also in some of the summary judgment pleadings, you will see that in December of 2011, shortly before the litigation was filed, he took to himself all of the records and everything else and essentially prevented her from being able to look at anything that would allow her to decide whether he was properly performing. And then in December, he told her he was unwilling to continue in this process with her. That's Exhibit P that was entered at the November hearing. It's about page 210 of the transcript of that hearing. And so by the time you got to December of 2010, their ability to cooperate in the selection of a replacement property manager had really kind of tanked.
Thank you.
Before the lower court, did you argue that paragraph 4 was ambiguous and should be interpreted based on parole evidence for the party's intent, or is your argument based on the document as written, plain language without parole evidence?
Document as written, Your Honor. Nobody in the trial court argued that it was ambiguous. The court mentioned that when he got into the January order, but no one in the trial court argued that the documents were ambiguous. We simply had different interpretations.
Thank you.
With respect to the ultimate interpretation of paragraph 4F, as I said, I think the judge conflated those two obligations. If you look at 4E, you look at 4F, it repeats in both paragraphs that Mr. Gagne is solely responsible for payment of costs over $25 per month per unit if he was unwilling and unable to continue providing the services, hands-on services, in excess of that amount, as the parties understood that to be. And I did note in preparing for oral argument, there is a mistake in our brief at page 23, the first full paragraph, and would ask that we be allowed to either withdraw it or that the court strike it because it does misstate the argument that we presented in the remainder of the case. With respect to the $1,700 loan in the J. Gagne employment contract, the judge afforded relief that no one asked for. He afforded relief that was on a derivative claim when Mr. Gagne had never gone through the process, Richard Gagne had never gone through the process of bringing a derivative claim. Now, with respect to how the process came about, Mr. Marsh was appointed as the receiver and then redesignated as the custodian. And throughout the time from January of 2012 until he was discharged in May of 2013, he never appeared, he never retained counsel, and there is nothing in the record indicating that this was relief requested by the LLCs. Certainly he could have done so under the statute 788.12, which defines the rights, the responsibilities and obligations of a custodian and receiver in the LLC Act. The claims were derivative, not direct, as between the LLC and Mr. Gagne. Damage, if any, was to the LLCs. The district court made numerous findings on that, which we've cited in our brief. Capital contribution to Library Park didn't benefit him when the judge converted that from a loan to a capital contribution. In fact, it was a benefit to the LLC because they then didn't have to repay a loan, and it was a benefit to Ms. Gagne when it was turned into a contribution because then under the terms of the LLC agreement, when the properties are sold, then she gets the capital contributions back first. He had no benefit and no detriment different from the LLC. Under those circumstances, we believe that was appropriate. I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Good afternoon, afternoon. May it please the court and counsel. My name is Jennifer Lynn Peters. I am here to, attorney registration number 31699. I'm here today on behalf of plaintiff Richard Gagne. I note right off the bat that it's clear this family is in a huge dispute in that both parties pronounce their names different. I will try my best to refer to my client the way he pronounces it and to Ms. Gagne and Jay Gagne the way they do. I'm going to start, although it was not my intention, with the findings related to Ms. Gagne's authority, or at least the trial court's finding that she had authority to unilaterally determine who the substitute or the next property manager would be if she terminated Home Solutions owned by Richard Gagne. I don't believe the trial court was correct in finding that, and here's why. Paragraph 4 in the parties' agreements, first and foremost, has to be read in its entirety. When you read it in the context of the entire agreement, what's clear here is that these parties intended that Ms. Gagne would put up the money and Mr. Gagne would provide the actual hands-on management experience and sweat equity.
Do you also agree that the paragraph 4 is not ambiguous and therefore we're doing a plain language interpretation rather than a parole evidence interpretation?
Yes, although I would note the trial court made findings that call that into question. The trial court in its order said these were poorly drafted.
But I'm not looking, you're not here arguing ambiguous contract parole evidence.
Correct.
Thank you.
Paragraph 4, taken in the entirety of the agreement, there's clearly an intent to involve and keep Richard Gagne involved in the property management. That benefited both the LLCs and Mr. Gagne. In part because it ensured there would always be an experienced real estate person to manage these properties who's on site in Colorado and at a specific rate, and to the extent that if the agreement was followed and his management was ever terminated, that the cost would be capped at what they agreed on. That's why we have paragraph 4. I think you have to read paragraph 4 starting from top to bottom. Paragraph 4 says, Home Solutions, which is Mr. Gagne's company, would manage for 24 months, at the end of which, if the parties unanimously agreed, a new contract with Home Solutions could be entered into. If they didn't, the next paragraph says, Home Solutions has the first right of refusal to continue to manage. That first right of refusal isn't triggered unless and until the parties don't agree to continue their contract. Otherwise, there's never an opportunity and no reason to use that language. So to give it effect, you have to read it as, providing a first right of refusal, which only comes up if there's not agreement to continue with Home Solutions.
But yeah. If Ms. Gagne says it was gross negligence or insurmountable difficulties, then you have to go to mediation.
Correct, and that's the next paragraph. Okay. The only way that first right of refusal could get passed is if Ms. Gagne says, and I think that has to be more than just her saying it, but if she determines there's been gross negligence or insurmountable difficulties between Home Solutions and the LLCs. In this case, that finding didn't happen by Ms. Gagne until after the lawsuit was filed.
Sure.
So he was appointed.
Yeah, I'm going to cut in here because I really want to get you to the judicial dissolution issue quickly. So
sure.
I want to see if I get the facts right here. What happened is Ms. Gagne sends a letter, or I think it was a letter, to the custodian, makes these findings. And this was after the mediation happened, makes those findings. Then there's a mediation that happens after that. We go to litigation. And I think that's the basis for the court's finding that the mediation provision was waived.
Well, I think she made that statement. She sent a letter claiming gross negligence without any support after the lawsuit was filed and the custodian was already
appointed. Sure, and then Mr. Gagne could have mediated if he wanted, but didn't, correct?
Correct, the parties did not go to mediation.
All right, so doesn't that put the HSI issue to bed at that point?
I don't believe so. I think there was a factual issue about whether or not there was proper authority for her to say I'm terminating based on those grounds.
But if there's a disagreement, don't you have to mediate under paragraph 4?
I think that's correct. It required mediation, which neither party requested and the court did not require.
Right, and the court, and then the district court said so the mediation provision was waived and no one's appealed that.
Correct. So mediation has not been appealed. The next step then is, okay, who is the next property manager?
Okay, right.
Under paragraph, and that's the next paragraph in paragraph 4. If it's not going to be Home Solutions, then Ms. Gagne has an obligation to involve Richard Gagne in the process to find a new property manager. And here's where we get to your question, Judge Gabriel. if she doesn't allow him the opportunity to cooperate or participate, if she decides to do it on her own without talking to him, which is what happened, then Equity, I think, has to step in to say he's not liable to pay as he agreed to do if he was involved in the process of choosing that property manager. Because the agreement's silent on what happens if it's Ms. Gagne who doesn't cooperate in getting his contribution or his involvement. The agreement only says if Mr. Gagne doesn't cooperate, then she has the sole right to choose. If she obviates his involvement and participation, I think the court's finding was correct that she can't also hold him to the other provisions.
Do you disagree? Okay, guess the answer. Ms. Smith told us just a minute ago that Mr. Gagne said he wouldn't cooperate with her in this process. I assume you disagree with
that. We do disagree with that. And I think if you look back at the record, what you will find is Ms. Gagne terminated Home Solutions, made no attempt to try to work with Mr. Gagne to find a new property manager. She just chose and hired one. She asked, and this is the problem we have with the entirety of the case and why we believe judicial dissolution should have been ordered here. She acts as if all decisions can be done on her own without involvement or disclosure to Mr. Gagne. And if she chooses to act that way, at least in regard to this provision, paragraph 4, she has no right to also say, well, you have to pay me too because I chose to hire the most expensive property manager I could find without your consent. There's protections built into the entirety of this agreement that protect Mr. Gagne, who's the minority voting interest member. And the trial court's error here, in our mind, setting aside the Home Solutions and ongoing first right refusal issue, was in not recognizing that based on his own findings throughout the case, that Ms. Gagne was not acting in conformity with their membership agreements. And because she already demonstrated, and the court found specifically, she did not follow the agreement, she in fact breached it, acted secretively, acted for her own benefit, acted to try to divert money from the LLCs to her son Jay Gagne, all without disclosure to the court or Mr. Gagne, that is evidence that she, and undisputed evidence based on the trial court's findings, that she won't and is not acting in conformity with the agreement. Judicial dissolution is required under the LLC statute in the event that it's not reasonable, practical for the business to continue in conformity with the party's agreement. In this case, the trial court only looked at, can we avoid a deadlock based on the reading, based on his interpretation of the contract. In applying that standard, the trial court was too strict, too narrow. Even though his order says things like, well, I think the statute gives us a little more breadth or a little more leniency, in the end, what he did was say, can they operate around a deadlock based on the plain language of the document? I submit
to you. Well, a little more than that, right? He said, can they operate around the deadlock such that they can make money? So the companies exist, so the agreement was to run apartment buildings and be profitable, and they're doing that. So I think it's a little more than you said.
Well, except that they were doing that under the control of a third-party custodian and being managed by Home Solutions, Mr. Gagne. The trial court never looked at and never considered, which he should have done at a trial, he never looked at or considered whether or not the facts were such that would continue if Ms. Gagne was put in control. And that's the reason we believe the trial court should not have decided this issue on summary judgment. This was an issue that, at a minimum, there were certainly facts that should have made the dissolution claim be heard at trial. I actually think, based on the trial court's findings in its January 22nd order, based that Ms. Gagne breached her fiduciary duty based on the language used about the party's relationship, that they have an utter failure to communicate, that they had acted vindictively toward each other, that they cannot cooperate. And based on the fact that there are still provisions in the agreements that require unanimous consent, such as refinancing if there's going to be equity cashed out, the withdrawal of Mr. Gagne, amendment of the operating agreement, such as to appoint a new manager, all of that requires unanimous consent. And the court sort of skirted that and said, well, I still think she can run it because she has this 51% voting under the plain language of the agreement. And I think those findings alone, if you look at the standards under a reasonable, is it reasonable, is it practical, and in conformity with the agreement, that they continue. This is the case why this judicial dissolution statute was written.
Ms. Graves, can you give me your definition of not reasonably practicable? I kind of got the court was following the Ocean Avenue case, and I didn't have a clear vision of how you would define those terms. And arguably presents a case of first impression for us. What's your definition?
It does. I think, and I can't remember which case it came out of, but in our mind, reasonably practicable means you look at the totality of the circumstances and whether it is logical, feasible, and not just possible to continue the operation of the company. And you have to look at, are the parties acting in conformity, or will they act in conformity with their agreement in going forward? And here, looking at the totality of the circumstances, and I think it's a fact-specific inquiry, I think the trial court was right about that. It's a fact-specific inquiry because you're looking at a reasonableness standard. We use reasonableness across all areas of the law. Attorney's fees, awards, it's the first one that comes to my mind because that's an issue in this case as well. But I think trial courts are well prepared to determine, is it reasonable? Does it make practical sense? As opposed to, can we avoid a deadlock? The issues that Ms. Smith talked about are issues where you can see it in the court's order. He's trying to carve a way to address these really significant issues that are not in conformity with the agreement and really speak to that Ms. Gagne maybe shouldn't be running these entities, given the totality of the circumstances, in order to avoid dissolution. He's stretching to try to get there. And in the end is looking only at, and I think the cases like Ocean Avenue are really only looking at, does it make money and can you avoid a deadlock? And if that had been the intention, we would see language in the statute that is more like the corporation's context where they refer to those issues. Does it make money and is there a deadlock? Colorado doesn't look to corporations law in resolving these issues for LLCs. They make the analogy that partnerships are more like LLCs. And in fact, the partnership dissolution statute, while it's more broad because it has more potential grounds for dissolution, uses the exact same language, reasonably practical. I think it's telling that the legislature did the same thing on this statute for LLCs. And I think that's why we suggested this court ought to draw from partnership law on dissolution in determining what the standard should be. And I realize that's a little vague. It's hard to define that phrase directly because in our view, it's a fact-specific case-by-case inquiry based on the totality of the circumstances and not just one overriding factor. There are numerous factors that could warrant dissolution.
Go ahead, Judge.
But all you're asking for is us to reverse the partial summary judgment and remand for further proceedings on the dissolution claim.
Correct. We believe it was error to resolve the dissolution claim on summary judgment. We believe the case should be remanded for trial on that claim, and I believe the court would apply the wrong standard and needs a direction on what standard to apply at that trial. That's what we're asking for in dissolution.
Now, you would, I think, agree just a mere disagreement is not enough, even a vehement disagreement, correct?
Correct.
All right. So what do we have to get a situation where the parties are going to repeatedly get stuck? Do we have to have allegations of, obviously, allegations of physical altercations in this case? Where is the line between, you know, a total breakdown and just mere disagreement?
Well, I think there's, and I think we see the evidence of more than mere disagreement here. It's one thing for an LLC member in a minority position to say, I disagree with every decision they're making. Here, what we have is a complete breakdown and wrongdoing found on the part of the controlling member. And you'll see in the cases we've cited in our briefs that wrongdoing on the part of one member is a reason to get to that dissolution standard. If you have, I also think, based again on the totality of the circumstances, if you have a situation like this where we have a small family company owned by two family members where they tried initially. Mr. Gagne had 51% voting interest. Ms. Gagne came in and tried to terminate his property management company. They ended up in litigation. When she took control, she hired Jay Gagne's friend who had no experience, resulting in more problems, and then brought back home solutions. They try then, okay, let's give Ms. Gagne 51%. They end up in litigation. They end up in a whole long mediation followed by more litigation. The circumstances here are such that we have more than just disagreement. We have parties who are going to, at every turn, end up before the court asking for involvement, receivership, and help resolving their disputes. We have a controlling member who's been found to have breached her duty to the company and her obligation of good faith. We have findings that she acted secretly and concealed for over a year, her attempt to just unilaterally appoint her other son, co-manager, directly contrary to their 2011 agreement that says no non-member will be allowed to participate in the business. And that is why we believe here we get past that standard of just a mere disagreement. So we would ask the court to reverse on dissolution. I didn't get to attorney's fees, so we'll stand on the brief for the rest of our request. Thank you.
With respect to the request for judicial dissolution, first of all, there are two standards of review that this court must apply. The original order on summary judgment is subject to de novo review, but the court's reconsideration is subject to abuse of discretion, just as it would in any other reconsideration motion that the court would consider. Now, with respect to the arguments concerning application of partnership and corporation statute, I suggest to you, Judge Gabriel, that the LLC statute has a significantly different context in which these decisions must occur. If you look to the statute, what the legislature said is that in deciding that in carrying out the purpose of the LLC statute, the court must give maximum effect to the freedom of contract and the enforceability of agreements. And that dovetails with the discussions about the fact that judicial dissolution is a drastic remedy. It is not something to be given liberally or given as anything other than really a matter of last resort. Sort of along the lines of an injunction would be the same type of equitable considerations.
Ms. Smith, in the interest of time, let me ask you the same question as Ms. Peters. What's your definition of not reasonably practicable?
When it as the district court said, it's fact-driven, but when I look at all of the decisions that were cited by both parties in the district court, the primary consideration seems to be two. If the parties reach an impasse where no one can move, the two sisters against the two sisters, for example, or when the managers exercise equal powers, when there is no way to get around an impasse in the corporation, the LLC is deadlocked, it's not reasonably practicable to continue. And then the second is the financially feasible question, and that is the economic purpose of the entity being served? And if you look at the custodial reports and things like that, there's no evidence in this record that these are financially unfeasible by any evidence that was offered by any of the parties. And so while there are considerations of things like, do the parties talk to each other? Can the parties be in the same room at the same time? Or do they start lobbing things at each other? All of those are factual considerations. But remember, this is contract driven. By statute, this is contract driven. And so when you look at the contract, when you look at the operations of the parties, can one party, one manager, continue to operate the LLC without the participation of the member? And I suggest to you that if you look at the LLC agreements in this case, the answer to that is absolutely.
Well, what do you do with the fourth or fifth whereas clause? The success of the company requires the active interest, support, cooperation, and personal attention of the members. I mean, it seems like this whole thing was geared to an understanding both members are required to participate. And now you're saying, to me, is that, well, yeah, if they can't get one, at least one of them can run, it doesn't matter. Why don't we have a fact question in light of that recital? And you said it's fact-driven. I mean, it's hard to imagine a case, with all due respect, with as much dysfunction as these two people have. Allegations of, his wife is spitting on her and he spit on her, physical altercations, ugly. It seems to me more just arguably not can't be in the same room. They can't work together. And why does that not get us at least a fact question on dissolution, on reasonably practicable that they can operate the company? Sorry.
That's okay. I just didn't want to interrupt you, Your Honor. Again, I think what you have to look at in this case is the paragraph that you recited is a recital. It is a whereas paragraph. When you get into the operating agreements themselves and you have the allocations of powers and responsibilities, you will find that there are three that control in this circumstance. One, she has 51% of the membership voting rights. Number two, she is the chief executive manager and is given raw power to manage the LLC, where he is not given. He is given power to operate the property manager, HSI. Third, she has the sole and unfettered discretion to decide whether these properties are going to be sold and these LLCs are going to be terminated. That was the agreements that the parties made and that were in place before Mr. Gagne began this litigation. And under the circumstances, when you look at the context of the LLC statute giving, again, maximum effect of freedom of contract and the enforcement of agreements, these parties agreed that Ms. Gagne would be the chief executive manager of the LLC. She carried every decision with 51% of the membership rights. Under those circumstances, if they can't get along, the LLC agreement can be interpreted according to the agreements of the parties to allow Ms. Gagne to operate this LLC for the purpose of making money through the apartment complexes that are owned and operated under each of the four separate agreements.
So is it basically your position that as long as it's profitable, and since she can make all the decisions of 51%, there is no level of animosity, bad faith, breach of fiduciary duty, that can warrant dissolution? I mean, it's that clear for purposes of summary judgment?
Your Honor, I would never tell you that I would advocate that. I'm running out of time. May I finish my answer?
Sure.
Okay, thank you, sir. Your Honor, I would never abdicate that kind of a position, but what I can say is that in the context of these operating agreements and the language that was used in these operating agreements, which the judge said was unprecedented in his experience, with the information and the allocations of powers, that these LLCs can continue to operate and have continued to operate even with the level of dysfunction between these two parties. So with respect to the remaining arguments, I will incorporate our briefs.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Before Judge Webb is going to step in, I know, and wrap up, I want to thank the parties, the counsel here, for your professionalism and civility. I know parties here have a difficult time working with each other. It happens. It's nice to see that the lawyers didn't, at least in this courtroom. So thank you for that.
You're welcome, sir.
On that basis, the case stands submitted. We will issue a written opinion in due course. Counsel are excused. When the tables are cleared, we'll move directly to our second case.